Hello and welcome to episode 172 of The Great and Crowbar. It is the 17th of January 2017. My name is Chris Thurston and tonight I'm joined by Philippa Waugh.
Hi.
And Tom Senior.
Good day.
Hello again. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Hello.
Good day.
Hi.
Good day. Hi.
This is quality entertainment.
Indeed,
for
it
all.
Is. And one of the reasons it's like that is because I forgot to find out before this podcast what the news was in the world of computer and video games.
Well, the news is about to happen because mere hours after we record this, Gabe Newell is going onto Reddit to do an Ask Me Anything session.
Oh.
Do you think anything will not to repeat last week's discussion of will Valve ever do anything ever again, but do you think anything will come of this? Like an AMA isn't the expose, right? Like it's not.
My instincts say no.
I think your instincts are good, Tom. I suggest that he will talk about the company's philosophy, maybe briefly, about knives.
Quite possibly.
Anything else happened this week?
It's been
a very January week.
Nothing is coming out.
It's been extremely
really
January.
Yeah. So it's been quiet, but we've been playing stuff, you know. We've been playing the video games.
Playing some video games, pottering along, enjoying ourselves. Pip, you've played some pretty current things this week.
Current things.
Current?
Yes.
Things
I
the
did.
Children are into.
Well, I mean, I guess, although the children probably have slightly different tastes based on what's on the YouTubes, Minecraft and so forth. But
the Overwatch, that's their favourite.
I'm not young. I can't speak to the interests of the young anymore. I just watch from outside. That makes it sound weird.
That does sound weird.
I'm going to move on. I've been playing Mysterium, which
we
is...
We played Mysterium, that's right.
Indeed, the digital version of popular board game Mysterium.
Yeah.
And I played I'm halfway through playing She Remembered Caterpillars, which is a puzzle game. Which would you like me to talk about?
Well, let's talk about Mysterium, because, you know, we were both familiar with the board game.
Yes.
We've owned it for a while.
We have.
And...
We've never unwrapped the expansion pack.
No, it's because we keep introducing new people to it. Mm. And that is the fundamental weakness of board game expansions, is I'm 90% sure that 90% of your time playing a board game is explaining it to somebody who's never played it. And therefore you never think to then go, and also we'll crack open this extra box of complicated rules.
Well, to be fair, I think that more is about adding extra suspects and things. But anyway, so Mysterium is a board game which is kind of somewhere between Dixit and Cluedo, if you've played either of them. And if you haven't,
Dix Cluedo
essentially
is my rap name.
You are a bunch of psychics and one person is a ghost, and the ghost is trying to communicate to the psychics which murder suspect, location and weapon are the correct ones to solve the murder case. And the only way that the ghost can communicate with the psychics is through little cards that are really beautifully illustrated, but also quite sort of ambiguous and dreamlike and have weird scenes on them. So it's a very indirect way of referencing what you're trying to get them to pick of those murderer location and weapon combos.
Yeah, very abstract pieces of like dream art that always have multiple components.
It'll
be like a chandelier, and the chandelier's shadow is a giant tarantula, but there are doves in the foreground above a beautiful staircase made of lollipops or something like that.
Yeah. And you would use that to signify the shed, for example.
Because
the spider is somehow relevant to the shed. So you start to see the kind of the way in which that introduces, you know, interesting gameplay and discussion and people sort of trying to work out what the hell the ghost is on about, while the ghost tries not to swear and bang their hand on the table and go, what about this are you not getting? And so essentially it has been translated into digital format by, I think it's Asmodee Digital and is it Playsoft maybe? Mm-hmm. As well as the game devs have been involved. I think it's that trio. There might have been some more people. Anyway, and so online you have that set up. You can set up a create a game lobby. You can say that you'll play as any of the characters, or you can specifically say you want to be a ghost or a psychic or whatever else. Actually, no, those are the two options. And then
there aren't any other options.
Yeah, right. And then you boot into the game, and then it becomes about the ghost seeing one version of the screen and then the psychic seeing the other version and being able to look at each other's options. And there's a chat window where you can discuss things with the other people if you're not on voice already. And the ghost, who isn't allowed to communicate in the game anyway, like, can't access the chat window. They can only see it, so they can maybe use it to learn how the people are thinking or respond to it in some way, but they can't interact. It's an entirely one-way communication. And so that is all interesting, but it only really worked properly as an enjoyable game when we were all on... When A, it was all people that I knew, because that was just more fun trying to figure out and have those sort of dynamics with, but also when we were all on voice and were sort of, when I was playing the ghost, I could listen to people argue about it and I wasn't giving any input, but it was more fun to hear them than to see them typing. And when I was a psychic, it was far easier to say, actually, I think it's this, or have that discussion rather than waiting for someone to finish typing, waiting for a thing to happen, all of those bits and pieces. I have played it with strangers, just picking a game at random from the list of lobbies. And I will say that people seemed really reluctant to use the chat boxes as well. It was a lot like everyone was playing a solo game that just happened to have a collaborative round at the end. So to explain that a bit, all of you are picking up a particular combination of suspect,
location
and weapon, but only one of them is the true one. So you have to get all of the ones that are assigned to you correct. And then once all of you have got a combo to choose for the group to choose from, the ghost indicates one of those using a last round of cards. And I don't really know how to sort of explain that in a way that doesn't make it sound complicated, but it kind of isn't. It's more about I needed to find a different way than the game suggests for squaring that as fitting with the fiction. Like, to me, I think I've decided that it's a case that all of the psychics are picking up different murders that have happened in that location. It's just that only one of them is this specific ghost.
Yeah, that's how I've
so that's how I kind of square it with myself. But anyway, that's kind of by the by. The other thing that the game doesn't really allow for, unless you are all on voice chat or otherwise sort of somehow communicating, is it is really one of the big pleasures of playing that game is the debrief afterwards, where somebody is like, what the hell did you mean by this?
Yeah.
And you're like, obviously it was the cook because it has this on it. And they're like, that's not a fork, that's a shoe. Yeah. Yeah. You're like, well, anyway. And so that is such a big part of the fun of it, is kind of calling people out on stuff or having them realize that actually something was staring them in the face all along and they just got hung up on the wrong thing. Or as the ghost, you get to say, yes, you had it completely right. And then you talked yourself out of it for a good 20 minutes. It really suffers from not having that built into the game somehow. Like, it could really do with a match history sort of wind up scene at the end to, like, so that you could, if you were on voice, like, look through it and explain yourselves, I guess.
Sounds like a really bad idea to make this game into a video game. Given it's... that, like, there's some very powerfully systemic kind of competitive games like Netrunner and, Twilight Struggle that translate very well to video games because it's all about just playing cards and numbers and competitiveness, whereas this is just a social kind of, like, experience, isn't it?
It is. There's a sort of puzzle solving. You can't fail. Like, there's a turn limit, basically. And if all three players haven't completed their particular trios
yeah.
in that time, you fail. Even as scoreboards and scores for like how quickly you manage things. So it does sort of, like, I wouldn't say it fails. I wouldn't say it has no place as a game, but it feels like a little party game to break out, like, if all of you have it and you can sort of jump on Steam and play a game quickly.
The way I feel about it is very much that as a solo player prospect, it doesn't work because playing a game about fundamentally human connection building against or with an AI is just, absolutely, why would you do that? Because AI technology just isn't there. And by the time that it is, they'll have enslaved us all. Mm.
but we'll have some pretty fucking rad board games on our hands.
Yeah. Yeah. But the reason that I do think that it very much has a place in my games library is that it allows me to play a game I love with people who don't live near me. So it is very much, it gives me the tools to play something that our group of friends is particularly fond of when, you know, one of them is like at least 4 hours away by train, another one is completely in the other direction in a place that just isn't easy to get to. There's, you know, there's a lot of, I think, value in it simply as a facilitator for those social engagements when you can't be in the same place, but you want to share some wine and an evening of a board game.
I think of all of the sort of almost purely social board games, it's probably the one you can translate to a computer because it's ultimately about images and you know, making a pretty binary decision after having a lot of sort of analog discussion among yourselves. It's not a very social game if you're the ghost because you have to say, be quiet. But I would say one other thing is that a particular thing, you mentioned it earlier, but the defining feeling of Mysterium for me, particularly as the ghost, is somebody being right about which card you're trying to get them to pick and then moving further and further away from it as they subsequently find some other way of twisting the information that you've tried to give them with these abstract cards. And in real life, the ghost sits behind a screen and can't really communicate anything. The only things the players can see is if the ghost has used any of its ravens, and each of the ravens represents a complete redraw of the cards. So if a raven vanishes off the top of the screen, it means that the ghost has kind of chosen to ditch its hand of cards and draw another one because it's obviously got nothing, which can just be used as a kind of example of like, I'm trying here, please don't take anything I take too seriously. But you also have to be pretty poker-faced, because if someone starts to talk complete bollocks, you can't just be like, oh, fuck's sake.
Yeah.
However, if you're playing over the internet and all chatting on Discord or something, then you can do whatever the fuck you like as long as you're quiet in frustration at your friends as they veer wildly off-piste in their interpretation of a perfectly straightforward picture of six houses in a row, meaning a box.
Yeah. Or like, it's a really heavy fish. What do you mean you didn't get iron from that?
Yeah, exactly. It's a fish's mouth. What do you mean you didn't get hinge from that? But yeah, you're right that like, unless you do it yourselves, it doesn't have like the kind of the debrief thing where someone like holds up a card you gave them and says, what did you think I was going to do when you gave me this?
Yeah.
I love when somebody is so clearly torn between two things, but they're going, oh, okay, so this could possibly represent, like, this person who seems really, like, conflicted, and then there's this other bit, and there's a bit of red, and blah, blah, blah. On the other hand, it could mean the cook, and there is a fork. You're just like, it's the fucking fork! Yeah. What is wrong with you? Why are you even entertaining this other ridiculousness?
Or it's even funny when it's the other way around. And, for example, you know, the clue you want someone to pick is a cellar, and you give them a picture that has a bear trap on it, and one of their other choices is a shed that has a bear trap next to it. There's nothing else that could be. Why would the ghost give me a picture of a bear trap if the answer wasn't the card that has a bear trap on it? And it turns out
that certain ghosts did not see certain bear traps on certain cards before they gave them to certain psychics.
And these are the arguments that you and your friends can enjoy for any $6.99.
That's a good price for that.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's quite
nice.
It'd be a good game if they, I don't know if they do if, like a 4-pack or something, but it'd be.
They don't. That's one of the things that I thought was a bit of a shame because you do all need a copy, and it's kind of like, okay, well, but at the same time, I didn't feel bad asking anyone to spend that money. Like if another friend wants to come along and join in, I wouldn't feel bad saying it's £7.
Like, yeah, it's within acceptable bounds for like a bit of a punt.
Yeah.
Couple of pints. Yeah, that's good.
A couple of pints. Like a pint and a half.
Well, if you live in Bath, obviously. Yeah. I think these things vary.
Yeah. So yeah, I enjoyed it. I'd happily like treat it as a break between other games. Also, because it's a lot unlike any other kind of either co-op or competitive game you're going to play.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it fits in a similar bracket to something like Viscera Cleanup Detail in that it's a way of spending time with friends but where you're not sort of fundamentally competing in a little way, because even when we play things where we're all on the same team like Dota or Overwatch or something, there's going to be somebody who gets more kills or kind of gets to be the star of that particular game that we're playing, or you know, in the case of Overwatch, literally gets play of the game. And so it can sometimes feel a bit unequal in terms of the amount of fun that people are having, whereas if you're playing something with either an entirely shared win condition or with a you know, where you're more making up what you're doing as you go along, like Viscera, that can be a lot more valuable for some people in the group, I think.
I suppose the other thing is that occurred when we were playing, and you can do this in real life as well, but, you know, there are not many games that allow you to do this over the internet, is kind of any number of people can play. Like, you know, if, you know, two people want to sit around a computer somewhere and take over one player and make the decisions for that player, there's literally nothing about the game is worse if you do that. Like, it's just everyone looks at cards and looks at each other's cards and all discuss what they think the cards are trying to tell them. There's, you know, if you have, you know, mate friends who live together or want to gather around a PC and play one game with other friends who live elsewhere, then it sort of supports that. So in a way, the looseness of it actually really makes it useful. The other thing, on the flip side, one thing I found just thinking about it was both endings to Games of Mysterium that we had like a loss, we had a victory, were quite tense and like quite exciting. Like either the final failure or like, you know, trying to get that final judgment right between all three people, because often you only have like one shot at it and there's a time limit on ultimately making a decision and things like that. And I think that benefited from it having some of the trappings of a video game at that point, where, you know, you literally have to press the button that is like end the game if we're right or wrong. And then you get the victory screen that tells you how well you did. Because in the board game, you obviously have like, you know, time limits and an ending technically. But my experience with board games is that those kinds of endings, which are the kind of like, we hit the goal, guys, can be a bit anticlimactic because the game just sort of ends when you have successfully or unsuccessfully resolved the thing. And maybe some of the onus is put on the ghost, kind of in like a GM role, to give that moment some impact when they say you're right or wrong. But the computer handles that quite nicely. It can, you know, make a show, you know, it can make a thing out of the timer ticking down and make a thing out of the victory or the loss.
Well, once you've selected which combo you think it is, it lines them up in reverse order.
Oh, yeah.
Or in order of votes rather, with the most popular at the top. And then it works its way along. So you see the ones that it isn't fizzing out of existence, and it gets, you know, like, so if you've got a lot of different players, it'll work its way through a few, and then you've got two left and you're like, I really hope that it fizzes out the one that we didn't go for.
Yeah. So. Yeah, just a little bit of presentation stuff that I guess makes those endings feel more more impactful. Because there's a lot of board games like that. It's not really a problem with the board game. It's just most board games rely on the players to give their endings a sense of weight. Because more often than not, it's like, you know, like, or particularly if like some kind of collection game, you end up with the stage where it's like, oh, we've reached the end. We've finished the final turn. And now we all do maths. And then we find out who the winner is at the end of the maths. And often the big reveal can almost be spoiled by whoever kind of like finishes their sums first and reveals which way it's gone one way or the other. Computers are really good at that. They do all the maths instantly and they can then show you who the winner is in an exciting way.
Yeah.
So that's maybe a case for it as well.
So I think in general, like it is really good if you are familiar with the game and looking to find a way of playing it online or with people who you don't necessarily see as often as you'd like. On the flip side, I think it struggles a bit if you haven't played it before, because you'd need to go through the tutorial for like, or go through the story mode to actually find out how all the different bits work, because otherwise the interface is kind of fiddly and a bit counterintuitive at times. And also, I don't see any reason for you to play it against the AI. That just feels like it defeats everything about the game, unless you're trying to work out how AI is coded through gaming it with keywords or something.
Right.
But, you know, but otherwise I think that there is definitely a place for it. It's just, there are a few caveats, but yeah.
Is it called Magisterium?
Mysterium.
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 Mysterium girl. Ghost with you.
Nice.
That didn't really work. Yeah, that's Pip original right there. Right. No copyright whatsoever.
We're going to get YouTube flagged.
That's right, you're under 30 seconds. So can't
yeah. And also, I don't think any algorithm would recognize that as what it was intended. So,
Tom, what have you been up to?
I've been playing The Long War 2, which is a mod for XCOM 2, the sequel to XCOM 1, which also had a mod called The Long War.
This is more official, right? This is
it's more endorsed, I think, by Firaxis, who have been working in tandem with the mod developers to create extra mods, like just small mods, like new like class variations and weapons and stuff, which they made available at launch for XCOM 2, just giving it a bit of, you know, Firaxis doing a really nice thing and kind of engaging with a committed modding team and getting them to kind of add value to their game from the very beginning. And this is the culmination of it. It's like The Long War 1, basically just a total rethinking of the XCOM formula. So it's almost as though it's XCOM 2 developed in a parallel dimension where everything lasts longer. But there are more kind of cool toys to play with. And
the cool slow dimension.
The sweet slow dimension where instead of just guns, sometimes you can strap a thing to your wrist that is a rocket launcher and also a flamethrower.
How does that work?
That's exactly how I just described. So it's like a rocket launcher and sometimes you burn stuff. Sorry?
Would you not burn the back of your hand?
It looks like looks massive. Oh, no, okay. No, okay. Apparently is the answer. I don't know how, but they're professionals. They're trained professionals. In fact, I think that class is called the technical class.
Oh, well.
So they're so kind of, they're such pros with fire and rockets and things. So that's just one example of just one of the new classes they've added. There's one called the Shinobi, which is like in addition to the Ranger, a new kind of close combat archetype. So normally in XCOM 2, whenever you're dudes level up, you get one of two choices about how you specialize their class. Now there are three for each level, so there are like three different tracks of ways you can specialize them. And also the game is designed to last for like 100 missions or something like that. And one of the big things about it is that in XCOM 2, you're constantly kind of scrabbling to survive, and every mission that you take is really, really important. And the idea of turning down a mission is really bad, because every time you turn down a mission, it will damage you in some way. Whereas in The Long War, you're constantly having missions thrown at you, and it's the big choices you're making are about which ones you choose to take for which rewards, and to what extent you want to kind of gamble a little bit more to get a little bit more back. So it's a very, very different kind of rhythm and design intention. And it's interesting to see a more team just try and design their own version of a game, and for the developers of that game to just let them and just endorse them and say it's a good thing.
I think the devs were big fans of The Long War originally, weren't they?
Yeah. Like,
I think when they were talking about XCOM 2 before it even came out, they were sort of citing that as an example of people doing interesting things with the game and sort of being excited about the community side of things.
Yeah, it's really cool. I think there's a good kind of lack of ego there from Firaxis' perspective. That they haven't gone, looked at XCOM and said, okay, the way we do it is XCOM, and that is what it must be. And any way anyone changes this corrupts it in some way or damages it. It's a good open-minded attitude that people with different ideas for this game can use the same formula to create different experiences. And The Long War is a very different feeling experience for XCOM. It's like there's less pressure, even though it's still difficult, but there's less kind of, it's less stressful. XCOM 2 is very stressful. And you get to have fun with the fact that you can field like 10 people instead of 6, I think, is the original.
I think it's 6 is the where you start or where you end. But yeah.
I think 6 is the max you can get to. But you can, you'd fill up to 10 people in one place, and consequently they throw lots more enemies at you, which changes the way the maps kind of work. The maps are the same size, they're still randomly generated. But you get a lot more just kind of crazy combos and things happening. Like, just, there's one time in an ambush, I managed to, like, I got the best rocket I've ever fired in XCOM 2, because I managed to ambush like 7 or 8 dudes on top of a roof, and rocket them all at once while I was still in stealth. So I put everyone in Overwatch apart from my one rocket launcher guy, which was actually, it was the rocket launcher on the wrist with the flamethrowers, was a technical class person. They fired the rocket, did massive amounts of damage, like took out 2 turrets and 2 or 3 kind of mooks. Then the roof collapsed and the survivors fell down, took additional damage from falling down. And there's just like one snake dude left in the basement. Just like, what the fuck just happened? Why am I here now? And why am I really damaged? And then, because I'd already snuck past 2 patrols to get there, suddenly the whole map is alerted when you break stealth in XCOM 2. And if everyone's on Overwatch, as the enemies start reacting to you, they get 3 shots. So there was just about like 3 or 4 minutes of just the rest of my team taking 3 shots at everything that moved around, just coming out, just the enemy in total disarray is getting shot up everywhere. And it was just an absolutely just amazing extension of what XCOM 2 does really well already. Mm-hmm. Just with, by introducing greater numbers, new gadgets, new kind of enemy varieties and everything. Like, it's a really deep mod. It really goes into every system and tries to change things to create this different experience.
Does it change the beats of that campaign at all, or is it still broadly the same?
No, it's
campaign?
Totally different.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, a lot of the narrative stuff is kind of, as far as I can tell, stripped out. And it's much more about, so each zone that you have contacted has its own kind of stats.
Hmm.
And so Advent can grow powerful in certain areas, and you might have to go there and kind of squash them a bit. And you're also looking at kind of maintaining your resource flow from all of the areas. So it's almost more like a 4X game in that respect, where you have these territories you're tending to rather than being pushed into this, you know, narrative, which is why it's such a brilliant idea for a mod, because people who are super familiar with those narrative beats now get this completely different thing that feels very different, which is for free. It's amazing.
Yeah, because I guess that was my concern, is it sounds great, but the fact that they do make the game longer and not more difficult, but certainly maybe requires more investment over a longer period of time.
Certainly.
Like, the fact that I kind of know where that's all, or I feel like I know where that's all going, and I kind of know what's going to unlock at what point and where I'm going to go to do what, makes it less appealing. But I guess if they're not doing that stuff, then that's actually quite exciting.
It is, especially with the new kind of class combinations you can develop as a result of the new classes and gadgets they've added. And they've just changed loads of stuff. Like, for example, you can't, so rookies, you have to get from the black market now. So resources are even more important. Like, supply is even more important, because the only way you get rookies in the stage I'm playing at is to go to the black market and spend. Which, and also now you can render corpses into other kind of materials. So you can, which is, they call it rendering, which is this disgusting idea that you kind of just melt down an alien into a vat and like a sauce or something, just kind of, you know, keep them on the heat until they turn into Illyrium energy or something.
What are we eating today, Dask?
tasty Xenos.
Yeah.
So there's loads of kind of little ideas. They've changed the economy in that way as well. So it's really interesting. I'm not quite unpicked like the full implications of what they've done to change it, because I've only managed to play like 5 or 6 hours so far, and it's a long campaign, so I'm not sure like if I can definitively say it's, you know, really super clever and reimagining of the formula that will work for 100 hours. But, you know, so far it's been, as someone who's played a lot of XCOM 2, really, really clever and interesting change.
And you said it wasn't necessarily like a big difficulty leap, because that was the thing with the original Long War, right? It was also like super hard.
I think XCOM 2 is so hard that it doesn't feel like it.
Right.
It's a different pace. It's that you can, because you have so many more people and you're getting so many more people all the time, losing one dude is not as devastating as it feels in XCOM 2, where if you've got that high level sniper and you lose them, it can feel as though your campaign's over, even though it isn't necessarily.
Mm.
It's almost a different, it's having more people just presents that those losses in a different way.
Yeah, that's appealing, because like XCOM 2 definitely has that thing of, like, eventually you probably have like an A team and a B team, and maybe you'll run half A team, half B team a bit, but you'll definitely know who the A team is.
Yeah.
And then if you fuck up a big mission where you've sent all your best people, not that the game's over, but it's just become really hard and probably quite unrewarding because then you've got to...
Yeah, it's a real switching off point, that moment in the XCOM 2 campaign. One of the things I love about XCOM 2 is that failure is built into the game so well, in that it does let you recover, and actually those lows make the highs pop even more. And it's part of the emotional arc of that of a good XCOM 2 campaign. But this, The Long War does a lot to soften that stuff. And there's other interesting kind of risk-reward decisions to be made. So, for example, when you get offered a mission in The Long War 2, you don't just go on the mission. You select a bunch of your soldiers and put them into infiltration mode. And over a period of kind of days, they will the percentage of infiltration will go up on that objective. And the higher it is, the lower the enemy presence in the area. Huh. So it incentivizes you to actually put in smaller teams. So you think, oh, maybe I could get away with just four really badass dudes here. Mm. And they'll infiltrate and it'll be a quick stealth mission and they'll get in and out. And I'll preserve my other 15 or 16 people and go on more missions with them. So it's more of this kind of stable management. Whereas with XCOM 2, I always felt like it was much more reactive on my part. I was always reacting to the disasters and just trying to overcome and firefight.
Yeah, like I always felt like, you had a lot of chaff at the start, and then whoever didn't happen to die would eventually become the greatest soldier humanity has ever
really
produced.
Which is really satisfying and fun. But yeah, you're right. When you lose those people, it's devastating.
Yeah. Whereas I quite like the things I always wanted were like reasons to send variable squads. Because squad size is one of the most important upgrades you can get in any XCOM game. Yeah. Not just because more people is more useful in every single situation, but because that means you're getting XP for more people. So, you know, it's more efficient in terms of leveling your Pokemon team, which is a substantial part of that. Hmm. So any reason to be like, you know, I always wondered if they would do like, this is a two-person job as an idea, but it's some informal way of getting you to think about,
can I
get away with this if I just send two rangers?
Yeah. And I think it just balances also the enemy presence. If you send fewer people, I think it does a little bit to balance the type of forces you'll fight.
Right.
Even if they don't fully infiltrate, they don't get to that like 80, 90, 100% infiltration. They might meet fewer forces than they might otherwise if they had just kind of gone in as part of a big team. But I'm still experimenting with it and kind of figuring out what the kind of maths behind it is. But so far it's been really satisfying actually.
Do you think any of the Long War people will end up at Firaxis?
I'm not sure, because they've formed a studio last year, actually, called Pavonis.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
And I think I checked their website earlier today, and they describe themselves as working on a pre-Kickstarter phase on a new game that is their own creation, which is another kind of alien invasion game, but it sounds like it has a different slant. So their description of their game is that it will be about aliens in orbit, and the game is about uniting Earth in order to meet the aliens in orbit rather than it being a kind of an XCOM surface campaign.
That's interesting. I'll keep an eye out for that.
Yeah, it's definitely worth watching. They remind me of the Total War mods. And what was the guy called? What was his name called? Darth...
Oh, yeah, I know who you mean.
Oh, gosh. This could be a show notes moment.
It's a show notes moment, but I know exactly who you mean.
And created the most incredible mods for Total War games, and he had an ongoing series from game to game, and eventually just made his own Civil War game, and it was brilliant. So they kind of remind me of that. This mod is actually kind of incubating with this close relationship with one particular series, and then hopefully breaking out and using that expertise to actually kind of create their own games.
Sounds rad. I really want to play that now, actually.
Sounds it's really interesting.
Very appealing.
I am so broken that it has made me want to play The Long Dark, because I was like, I think I've played that. And I was like, no, I have played a game with two of the same words in the title. That did have lovely lighting. I will play that.
I didn't need to go back to The Long Dark actually, as well, I think. Because I've played it like, it feels like years ago now, probably a couple of years ago.
Yeah, same. I played it as soon as there was a version to play, and then I haven't really played it since, so I'm sort of thinking that certainly enough time will have lapsed that there's stuff to do.
I still remember it really quite vividly because of the art style and because
it's so good at creating the sense of like that magic hour of lighting.
Oh yeah,
I was talking to Adam about this today. It's like it's got a real handle on that, but that is not XCOM 2 things. No. So
though I did have an intense experience going into like a place and finding a wolf, and it's really fucking scary. So yeah, I'll check out The Long Dark. Actually, it's good.
Pip, you've also been playing She Remembered Caterpillars.
Yeah, I think I'll only talk about that briefly because I think Tom Francis and I talked about it not too long ago.
Yeah, the puzzle sort of side of it.
It's a colour-based puzzle game where you have to guide little coloured sprites along pathways to white pads so that they can then just sort of float off. It works by, so the two main gating methods, certainly at first, are that you have bridges, coloured bridges, where only things that have an element of the colour featured on the bridge can cross. So if it's a blue bridge, anything that is blue, green or purple can go across. And then you've got blue gates or other coloured gates, and what that means is pretty much the exact opposite. So you can go through it as long as there is nothing blue about your sprite. So
yeah,
you'd need to be orange or yellow or red. And so that actually adds up to some quite satisfying puzzling, which I have found so far, and it introduces a new sort of thing each act you go through. So each sort of collection of levels, you move up an act on this sort of fungal thing. And you get to introduce maybe a new colour. So after a little while, you get to combine two sprites together and you can kind of do interesting things with that. Or I think the thing that I unlocked most recently is there's like a blanching tool. So if you stand next to like a, almost like a petrol pump of the right colour, then it will either take that colour away from you and leave you completely plain, or it will spit that colour onto a plain thing, and so it can change. You can essentially use them to change your colour and rejig your pathways around the world based on that. And so that stuff has actually been satisfying. It hasn't been hard as nails in the sense of Stephen's Sausage Roll. Like, I've rarely been stuck on anything for a significant period of time, but it still has that satisfying thing of not seeing the solution instantly. You sort of see glimmers of it and you experiment a bit with it, and that's satisfying. It's more that, and the world is beautiful, like the art style is so lovely, and I think there's a lot about the world building that is really pleasant to be around. There's a kind of warmth to it and a kind of otherworldly loveliness to it. The thing that I'm not entirely sure about at the moment is that when I played it, I think it was, well, it was called Perlinoid, and it only had the puzzle side of things, but they have since added a narrative, or a kind of there are story elements that unfold,
like,
and dialogue,
a theme
and
kind of thing, right?
Yeah, like kind of flavor text almost, but more than that, it's kind of like it's little vignettes that are suggestive of a story, I think is perhaps the best way to explain it. And those unfold between each of the levels. And I'm not entirely sold on the connection between those two things. Mm. I think the thing that I like about the story parts is that I feel like the language that they use often fits the sense of place that the rest of the game creates. They're gentle, and there's a kind of fondness and a kind of familial element to them, but the actual story that they seem to be telling feels both a bit too distanced from the act of puzzle solving that you're going through, but also a bit too pat in terms of, if it's about sort of mortality, then the idea that you're going through a bunch of puzzles and finding resolutions feels a bit too on the nose.
Mm.
Like, if you're trying to figure out a difficult, like, situation external to the puzzles, then, like, going through these things where you're tinkering with solutions, it just feels a bit too over simplistic.
Mm.
But I you know, I'm only halfway through at the moment, and so I'm kind of reluctant to write it off without seeing the full effect of it, but also because it is doing a little bit of adding to the sense of the world. And I think even if it doesn't impact, or even if it doesn't help with how I experience the game, when I was reading about it, I think that the narrative side helped them come up with the new title, which in turn is a lot more memorable, and it will help that game, I think, stick in people's minds. But also I wonder whether it maybe gave them, as designers and developers, something to anchor the game around a bit more strongly, and gave them more of a sense of what it was. So it's that weird thing of, I really don't think that the narrative is working, but also that sort of sneaking suspicion that maybe it wasn't working for me as a player, but maybe it did a good thing for the developers.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's an interesting take on it, actually.
So, yeah. So it's an odd one, and I haven't quite settled on whether I ultimately think that the narrative was a failed integration in the finished game.
Mm.
But I think we will see, because it certainly isn't adding nothing. If you, does that make sense? Like, that's, yeah.
So what's that one called?
She Remembered Caterpillars.
Tom did not remember caterpillars, but thank you for reminding me.
Well, indeed. But yeah, so yeah. And if you are into that particular kind of spatial logic puzzling, I think it is a good,
it looks gorgeous
addition
as well
to the genre. And even if you get stuck, it's pleasant being in those environments.
Mm.
So yeah, and the little animations are really cute. Oh, and I should add, it is colour-based, but I was looking at the designs and they have attached a shape, a geometric shape to each of the different colours. So even if you have a particular strain of colour blindness, or a particular sort of flavor of color blindness, what's the word for a variant, then I think you should still be able to make it work. It might just be a bit awkward given some of the gates are positioned a bit, you know, at an angle to the camera, so you might struggle to make some of those out maybe.
Yeah. And I suppose maybe the combinations of colors aren't as obvious as combinations of shapes.
I can't remember whether the number of sides of a thing is relevant.
Because yellow is a triangle and orange is and red is a square.
Red is a square and blue is a circle. And I think that purple might be a semicircle. So there might be a relation between them. But essentially, like, I think they have made an effort to, you know, cater to...
That's good.
People with colour blindness.
A good little gam.
An interesting one, yeah. Mm. And for, you know, certainly a good one for people like me who enjoy those kinds of puzzles, because I'm just sort of sat there listening to my Mariah Best Of CD going, yep, singing away, forgetting Chris is in the other room today, asking him how soundproof the room is.
Not at all. Not at all.
Turning it off.
Quite a shame, really.
Puzzle. But yeah, so that's been me. What have you been up to, Chris?
So this week I have been spending a lot of time in Elite, actually, which is a game I perennially return to. And I spoke.
Is it the aliens that lured you back?
So that reminded me that I loved that game, but I have no. Well, actually, right where I just stumbled across my first little signs of what the aliens are doing to the galaxy, because Elite is a game I checked back in on when I reviewed it years ago now, for PC Gamer. My feeling about it was that I loved the groundwork they had laid. Like, I love the interface. I like the physics of it. The sort of internal logic of all of its systems, even if what that amounted to was truck simulator, but without the real life attachments of getting to go for a drive through Sweden or whatever. And I felt like it was a brilliant foundation to build interesting things on. And, you know, I returned to it again when they added, planetary flight on, moons, basically on atmosphereless planets. So you can land and drive around in a little buggy on a variety of different places. And I returned to it briefly, recently, and then bounced off. So I'm always sort of going back to check out these new things. And I think its rate of development has been, you know, quite slow, like, particularly because its sights are set a little bit lower than all of the things that Star Citizen is advertising at any given time. Like, their latest sort of push was like, we've invented 2 alien languages and we hired a linguist to do it, which is kind of mad. And Elite feels like it's operating at a much slower scale, but at least it's sort of out there and it's doing its thing. And the reason I love going back to it is because I find it incredibly relaxing. I think I get something out of it that people also get out of Truck Simulator, but I find real roads quite stressful, whereas space is sort of just nice, just out there. And this time around, I've actually sold all the guns off my ships. Like, I have no weapons. I transport stuff, but normally, like, sort of a little bit of smuggling and a little bit of just doing missions for my faction, just sort of a pro-democratic kind of welfare thing. So moving medicine around and supplies and things like that. And so I guess at the bottom level, the kind of the moment-to-moment pleasure of that game remains a combination of the satisfaction of doing an atmospheric but quite technical action well. So, even though if what you're trying to do in Elite is make money, and ultimately that's kind of what the game's about, to go up to the next load of ships, then, for example, any sort of mission or delivery that takes you to a planetary installation, like a city or a military base on a moon, is probably not worth it, because landing in atmosphere or like landing planet side is an extra degree of faff relative to going straight into a station and docking there, which is the sort of the rhythm of Elite. But there's something I love about the scale that implies. It's probably the best space game I've ever played for just making you think about how big things are. Like, when you know, sometimes you get a mission to deliver, you know, medical supplies or guns or like riot suppression gear. And each of this stuff, like, doesn't really mean anything. It's just whatever the name is of the units in your cargo hold. But for me, I find it evocative of what's going on in the galaxy. And you could say there's no story or anything, but like, I like the sort of notion that I'm piecing it together. And if someone in one station, when one sort of highly populated, high class, high tech space station is telling me they'll pay me a huge fee to deliver riot suppression gear to a planet side city a couple of systems over, that suggests a little story to me. Like, why is that stuff necessary? And also, sometimes you'll get into systems where not all of the planetoids in that system will be listed on your locations map. I need a kind of exploration scanner sometimes to find cities that are there, which is a bit of a weird conceit that no one can just tell you, oh, it's over there. But until your computer knows it's there, you can't warp to it. Like, you know, so you find yourself sort of like trailing the traffic as it leaves the sun, where most of the smaller ships have to warp out into, or all of the smaller ships have to warp to. And, you know, scanning and then finding these moons and sort of like making your way down, and the feeling of like moving at vast speeds away from a star towards, you know, a group of orbiting planetary bodies, whatever form they are, and knowing that the target city you're in is like somewhere in there, and you can see just the tiniest little speck, and you get closer and closer and closer and closer, and then you realize that the city is not actually on the planet you've been zipping towards, but on a moon of that planet, which is even smaller, and you can only see that when you're much closer, and the planet turns out to be a huge gas giant, and you didn't realize this, and you go in towards the tiny planet. So this actually happened, like, this is beat for beat, you know, the other night, and then you get even closer on this little moon, and I've started to develop little techniques. Like, the first time, like, once you're down flying at a planetary level, your speed is capped, like, you know, close to normal aircraft, and you're flying across, like, you know, in some cases, hundreds of kilometers of terrain. So that's not a good thing, because then you have to fly like you're a legit an airliner and it takes forever. So it makes a lot of sense to come in, to enter the atmosphere as close as possible to the place you want to land. And that just takes a bit of time of learning, like, what distance you want to set, what you want to orbit a planet, so that you can maintain your kind of super cruise speed before kind of like banking sharp into the planet, but not too fast, because that can interrupt your ability to enter orbital cruise, and then out of orbital cruise into a glide, which requires like a certain descent angle. And all this stuff sounds mega complicated, but actually I find it very intuitive. And like, and it's fun when like, I just got my new ship, which is a much bigger kind of transport ship, with a fighter bay, which is a cool new thing you can do to launch a fighter out of your ship. And it has a bit of a clunkier profile when it comes to doing this stuff. But then like dipping your ship into the sort of, you know, into the atmosphere of a planet. Well, not the atmosphere, but, you know, the sort of, it's gravity. So you're sort of beholden to it at that point. At the point where you can sort of like describe this sort of spiral around the city, knowing that you're kind of enter it into your glide and then you exit your glide and you've nailed it and you're about 5 kilometers above the city, kind of coming down really quickly, which is the range at which you can, or within the range at which you can then request docking permission.
Hmm.
And then you can sort of like, I don't know, it sounds dumb, but you've just executed something that you take for granted every time you see it happen in a cutscene or every time you see an AI do it. You know, when players do it, it can often be a bit haphazard, but doing it smoothly is just really satisfying. And like, you know, now I know how to tell which way around a landing pad is, which took me a surprisingly long time given how much time I've spent playing Elite, that the little, like command tower on a landing pad is always at the far end as you come in. So if you know where that is, you can always come in at the right angle and like sort of smoothly into a descent. And they've really done a little bit of work to kind of spice up the voice acting and stuff. So there are loads of different voice actors for stations and like, you know, air traffic control. So they'll have different accents. There's a woman from Yorkshire who runs a lot of space stations in certain parts of space. And they refer to the specific class of vessel that you're flying and say like, you know, Lacon type, whatever. We've got you on your scanners. Please make sure you request docking permission. So it's a little bit more personal than it used to feel.
Yeah, that's cool.
And it's just about this little like ambient sense of place, even if it's a lonely place because you're just a sort of lonely.
It's always great at that. I love that they're kind of doubling down on that and putting the extra resources into doing the stuff that Star Citizen kind of with its ambition and kind of sprawling nature might not be able to kind of paid as much attention to.
Yeah, so there's those feelings of like, huh, now I'm here, like this is, you know, like, even though obviously all the interactions are quite binary at the end of the day, and then there's, you know, landing, and then what that allows you to do is when you decide to go off piste a bit or just sort of explore, there's an amazing feeling that I might have talked about in the podcast before of like genuinely feeling like you're seeing stuff that other people haven't necessarily spent a lot of time seeing because it's so vast. Like I very rarely see other players even though I'm playing online, and you do occasionally, but, you know, not often. Doesn't often interact with what I'm doing either. Like, for example, recently, one of those journeys found this moon that sort of was the tiniest thing in space as far as I could see. And I come down towards it, and it's almost, like, crisscrossed with, like, a checked lattice. Like, almost, it's like it's got squares on it. And I realized as I was coming in that those are canyons. And I thought, and the city I was traveling to is on a plateau, like surrounded by canyons, but the entire planet is just a network of canyons. And I was like, oh, that's cool. And I completely misjudged the scale. I thought, what I'll do is I'll come down really fast. This is in an older, faster ship into the canyons and then like, you know, skim the canyons all the way, like, you know, Beggar's Canyon back home all the way to the city and then just sort of pop out next to the city. And I like literally like almost put myself in a nosedive and I realize I'm still like, you know, 30 kilometers up and the canyons aren't really getting any bigger. And I get closer and closer and closer and closer and they're huge. They're absolutely vast. These things that were just like lines on a texture from space are actually like, you know, about 3 kilometers wide and like 10 kilometers deep, like vastly deep. Like every one of them is like a mega grand canyon and my ship is completely lost in them. So much so that they're sort of the thing I expected, which is to like be weaving through these canyon walls, isn't possible because they're so big. They're like, you know, bigger than the, you know, the biggest space station in the game. You could fit them in there.
Like waggling a sausage in the Albert Hall.
Indeed. Like waggling a sausage in the Albert Hall. Mm. Which unlike waggling a sausage in the Albert Hall was actually kind of profoundly satisfying. Like just this sort of image of my like little lonely space cruiser kind of just flying through this sort of desolate landscape. It's that hard sci-fi, you know,
it's a itch. Very you thing as well. Yeah. Like I came in to offer you a cup of tea the other day and you made me watch you land your spaceship in a space station.
There's just so many lovely, yes. There's so many lovely little things about it. And just now I've started to encounter the edge of some of where the alien stuff like that comes in. So to catch you up to speed, because I had to pick up to speed, essentially there are now sort of like people have found more and more of these alien artifacts like spores out in space. And apparently you need one in your cargo hold to have that encounter that people have seen where you get pulled out of hyperspace. But these artifacts, these unidentified things in space are in high demand because they're obviously completely unprecedented. But they slowly break down any electronic system that they're near. So if you have them, if you're in your cargo hold, your ship will just fall. Well, eventually what will happen is the cargo hold will break and they'll fall out. So you can't hold on to them for very long.
Mm. Oh, that's a cool, like, mechanism for getting them to, like, not be hoarded.
Yeah. But there is there is one scientist in the galaxy who can, for a cost, sell you a cargo hold that has been insulated against them. And it has been insulated with materials also salvaged from what appear to be like alien barnacles that are found on certain worlds.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's basically two competing materials because they cancel each other out, basically, which is an interesting idea. Mm. But one really cool thing that they've inserted into the game is if you sell a bunch of those artifacts to a space station, so those artifacts are now on that space station, the space station will start to break down. So it will start, its functionality will start to shut down. I just hit one of these now. So it will lose its ability to repair your ship. It will lose its ability to give you missions, to sell you things. And the only way to fix the station is to deliver them loads more of those alien meta alloys, which are found in a different context. So my little self-set mission now is going to be to find a lot of meta alloys for this station that I've stumbled across that's breaking down. But also this ties into not really the PvP game, because that is still kind of quite isolated in particular places, but like the kind of the faction war that is Elite on its broader scale. Like players pledge allegiance to one of like a dozen political leaders that are split between the three factions and independents. And your faction leader has their own little bit of space and has their own claims in areas that they're trying to expand their political influence into. And most of them are defined by like the rewards you get, but also the kind of the platform they represent, which is like pro-slavery, anti-slavery. Like there's a reformist faction within the Imperials and the Federation, which are basically like space fascists to some extent, have a moderate faction within them that is more focused on sort of like a socialist platform, which is the one I'm flying for at the moment. Hmm. But, you know, players can then use those artifacts to sabotage stations within political rivals' territory, which is a super cool idea, like a little insert. And obviously, because it's mega inconvenient for people to suddenly find that the station they're relying on can no longer sell them stuff because they shut down exports. Like, and there'll be a little news story if you go to the news channel in that station that will say, this has started to happen, so we're shutting down the shipyard because we don't want to sell you any ships. And, you know, there's like, you know, little messages that will say like, you know, consider a full decontamination of your ship before you leave, Commander, which is like just flavor, but it kind of gives a sense that something's happening in the galaxy.
Yeah, yeah. That's so cool. I love that they've chosen to, like, it's the most elite thing to use commerce as a weapon.
Yeah.
And that they've managed to realize that by using kind of commodities and, you know, transport and freight as a means of kind of physical attack. That's very, very cool.
Yeah. And I guess one of the problems with the game is that everything you ever do as a player is sort of minute in the grand scale sure. of things, right? It applies to everything from how small you are relative to the...
But I know I'm sick of games, don't me? I'm the big kind of fucking hero center of the galaxy. I love this idea of being a kind of cog.
Yeah. Like my dude in Elite is just called Thurston. And I did that basically at the time, because I realized that because it formats you as Commander whatever, and so you end up with like Commander Cool Dude 89 or whatever. But for me, I like the immersion of looking over at the UI panel, because basically at the moment you don't define what you look like at all. So as far as I'm concerned, it's just me, and I just load the game and I'm in my space car driving my space place. I do, you know, want to set up the Vive again so that I can play it with the Vive, because it does work brilliantly with that as well. But there's that sort of like particular sense of like, this is my little life in space. And since I started playing that game, as soon as it came out, I've had like a little life in space, like initially as a, you know, a sort of flying around doing soldiery things for the Federation, to being a bounty hunter in Imperial space, to being a smuggler in Imperial space, to kind of returning to the Federation and now like, and literally selling my guns and just realizing that I got a bit tired of blowing people up in space and I kind of just wanted to haul things and smuggle stuff, and now I've got my bigger ship and I brought on crew, which you can do now.
Oh, cool.
They don't really like, they have little sort of randomly generated bios and personalities and randomly generated faces, which go to some weird places. Like its face generation is a strange one. You mostly use them, or I think at the moment only use them to manned fighters if you don't want to fly the fighters yourself. But it's kind of nice to know that they're there. Like, I have this sort of little internal sense of, like, because my current ship is massive, so, or it feels massive. So I can imagine there being, you know, crew quarters and, like, a little life on board, a little serenity simulator in that way.
I'm guessing they're not, like, characters in any sense beyond the bio.
No. They have a little headshot and stuff in their name.
That's right? Not nice.
Yeah, it's enough, but, like, the thing is, like, in Star Citizen's sort of praise, or to Star Citizen's credit, it has started at that point. And so all of the ships have beautifully detailed interiors that you can walk around. They have toilets. They have bedrooms. They have all the things you'd expect they would need. Whereas you have to kind of imply that stuff in Elite because you see your cockpit. And if you get into a fighter or the SRV, which is the buggy, you sort of fade to black and you're in the cockpit being deployed out of the ship. And it's all really cool, but like you have to imagine what the corridors are like. If you are prone to imagine what corridors are like in space, as
but
I am.
It's weird because it feels like, certainly listening to you or listening to other people who are into Elite or who have sort of found their way into it in a way that I didn't, like, it's doing that thing of it's built up from, I don't want to say simple, but relatively simple in comparison to something like Star Citizen. And it's gradually growing and it's gradually finding things to add and it's approaching things like the existence of aliens in a legitimately interesting and also attention-grabbing way. Like, people were so excited. And I don't play the game and I I'm really not into space games per se, but you showed me that video, Chris, and I was like, it was amazing.
It's cool, isn't
it? Was so cool. And so they feel like they've come from the sort of maybe slightly more mundane or straightforward element and are working their way up and doing cool things in the process and making their game cooler. Whereas I feel like Star Citizen has just the amount of hype and controversy already attached to that game. Like, even if they manage to do all of those things, the reaction won't be, and that is cool. The reaction will be like, and yet my space toilet is blocked. What
maybe.
Gives? You know? Like, I can't help but feel like that is the thing that might happen and that they'll sort of meet each other going in opposite directions.
Maybe. I mean, I'd love to see a little bit more movement from Elite on a more regular basis because it feels like it's been a long time since Horizons now. They just had the Guardians update, which is the one that added ship launched fighters. But I know that when that was announced, it felt like it was heavily implied that that would be like ships you could crew with your friends so that, you know, we would fly around together and I don't know, you know, you would be the fighter pilot and you can deploy from my ship and fly around in a wing with me and then dock again or whatever. Whereas actually it's like you launch your fighters or pilot them yourself and, you know, that's like, it's still quite a lonely experience even if you can play with people. So, you know, and then, you know, they've said that they're going to, the crew system is obviously their kind of first pass at like having human faces in the game because there weren't any previously. Everyone was just sort of wearing a flight helmet and the crew members have randomly generated faces and they were all in the 70s, which is weird. One of the weird casualties of that random generation is that like it's just a lot of old ass looking people who want to fly in your spaceship.
I think that's pretty cool.
It is totally. It only is. It's just it sort of struck me by like, hang on.
They've survived long enough to know what the hell they're doing.
Exactly. But they said, you know, that might be a precursor to making your own avatar and being able to explore space stations on foot and things like that. And that has all been, I mean, who knows how far along in development it is, but it's felt sort of quite slow, you know, like the rate at which new things are announced for Star Citizen is very exciting, despite that game being in a much less playable state and being so vauntingly ambitious.
But are the developments keeping up with those announcements in any way?
What do you mean?
Well, you're saying that new stuff is being announced.
And shown. That's
pace.
What I mean. Like, new stuff is being shown for Star Citizen all the time. Like, they will demonstrate, like, this is what we've done. Like, and, you know, the resources being expended on it are clearly, I think, probably vastly out of proportion with what Elite
costs. Oh, I know.
Costs.
But what I'm saying is, like, the scaling of expectations feels sufficiently different that I feel like elite can maybe only go up, or I mean, it can definitely go down, because I've seen some of the controversies around that game and around Frontier, you know, come up and sort of bubble up in the community and things. Yeah. But like in broader terms, it feels like they have a more realistic bar from which to go up, whereas Star Citizen has an astronomical bar from which to fall down.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think, yeah, like every time Elite gets something genuinely cool, I'm kind of like, oh, wow, ship launched fighters. I want one of them.
Hmm.
Whereas, you know, the expectation of what Star Citizen will deliver day one are pretty high. They also have an enormously forgiving community, though, which is, I suppose, part of it.
Hmm.
Because they have a lot of heavily invested people who are really on board with it. But yeah, like, you know, the two don't necessarily have to exist always in comparison with one another. I just, you know, it's been nice to rediscovering Elite, because I think when... it's a good sort of mind-settling game for me. Just go into space, drive from a truck, landing on places, landing in places, queuing to land in places, that kind of thing. Running away when someone tries to steal my stuff rather than fight them. Nice.
Shall we do questions? Yes.
Oh, I jumped the gun there.
No. Well, I mean, I left a weird pause.
You did.
I really did.
So that leads me to my first question.
Mm.
Or our first question.
Yes.
Which is from F, who writes, what is Pip going to drink first once dry January is over?
Well, I mean, I have wine right now because I'm not doing Dry January.
I wonder where you got the impression that you were doing Dry January from.
I don't know. She... Do you think it was because I had a cup of tea last week?
Well, that's... Who knows what was in that tea?
That's true.
Rum.
I'm amazed that you could listen to the end of last week's podcast and think, Pip's doing Dry January.
Well, to be fair, I wasn't drunk that week, which maybe I should say that I was, as like a
yeah,
as
you've as blown a defense. It now.
I really have. I think I don't really drink much at all. Like I'll sort of go for, you know, for wine with friends or whatever. But I mean, I don't like I've really gone off the taste of it, to be honest.
You don't appear to have gone off the taste of wine, Pip.
No, you've no, got a but I mean, glass of wine like, there. When it was last week, the reason that I wasn't really drinking was because I just didn't really fancy rum, because I don't really like the taste of rum much, you know? Mm.
But nonetheless, so, not a dry January by any
not
any
exactly.
Shakes.
Sort of maybe a moist January.
If you were doing dry January.
Yes.
And you were returning to the world of drinking after a month's absence.
Yes.
What would you return to first?
Do you know, I think I would probably do something like go to that nice cocktail place. Is it the Dark Horse?
That place is good.
Yeah, and just sort of maybe just have something silly fancy, you know? Because, like I say, it's, you know, I don't think that I would get to the end of 30 days and be like, oh, I must have a drink. But I think if I was celebrating being able to drink again, then... for whatever reason, then I would go for something a bit over the top and that felt a bit more like a special occasion, I think.
Hmm.
So, but yeah, I don't know. I've just not had the taste for it, which is probably very boring and not games related.
No. But, you know, nice guess. You were wrong. Drew writes, speaking of... I guess January things. Any games related New Year's resolutions? Mine, finish at least one game a month and play each humble monthly game for more than 1 hour.
Hmm.
It's a worthy thing. I've tried to do the play, finish games you play / play a certain amount of games a month thing before. It didn't work.
I play short games, so that tends to be fine for me. I think, because I did make not exactly a resolution, it's something that I come back to or try to remind myself to do every now and again, and New Year is a as good enough a time as any to do that. But that's to let people know when I like what they've done. And some of that is talking about games that I've played, even if it's just a little bit, or if I liked an aspect of them, and making sure that I've said that on RPS, if you know, it's relevant to the audience or something. But also in terms of fellow writers, you know, getting in touch and saying, hey, I really enjoyed this thing, or this was thought-provoking, or it made me think differently about, you know, this other thing. And, you know, beyond the games industry, but I think in the games industry it is so easy to get, you know, to the end of an article and see a sea of, you know, comments that just pull apart particular things, or, you know, say, but you missed this, or you didn't say that, or, you know, unrelated other complaint. And so I think trying to make a conscious effort to inject a bit more, but this was great,
yeah,
to people who maybe don't hear a lot of that, feels meaningful.
That's a good idea. I don't think it's a resolution per se, but mine is, well, my twofold thing. One is being sort of allowing myself to move on from games when I'm legitimately not getting anything else out of them or not enjoying them, rather than feeling compelled to max everything out. And the other side of it is just to maybe try and finish some more of the small form narrative games that I'm always really interested in and typically miss. So hence finally playing Firewatch and others.
I think I have less of a resolution and more of a hope that I will become like deeply invested in a game this year. That some game pulls me in to the extent that I like. And weirdly, in recent years, it hasn't really been PC games. It's been Destiny and Bloodborne that have really done it.
Like, yeah.
Really gone beyond what other games have done for me, where I've just become slightly obsessed with them. And they've become a part of my like rhythm, everyday kind of gaming life, and I've just drawn so much kind of out of both of those games in terms of both social experiences with other players, but also just intrinsically for how well designed and brilliant they are. And I just really hope that happens again, and hopefully for a PC game this year rather than those.
Cool. Maybe this is your year for Dota.
No, I keep trying, but it's not normal. Dota's going to happen.
Next up, questions from emails. Juice writes, ho, crow, Creighton Crow Bobituates. I need help. I'm very much into RPGs. I played the old Ultima games as a wee juiceling. I went on to enjoy the Baldur's Gate games onto Morrowind, more recent offerings like Dragon Age Inquisition and more. And though I thoroughly enjoyed many of these fine games, I find myself running into the same damn problem. Walls of text. Now, I'm quite an avid reader. I've got so many books in my upstairs office that I'm worried as to whether I'm damaging the building with their combined weight. On a page, large numbers of words are absolutely a non-issue, but the same words on a computer screen, especially in the context of a computer game, and after a couple of lines, it magically turns into blah, blah, blah. I just can't focus on it. As you can imagine, this means I often miss out on the finer points of many games' lore. I love lore diving, so much so that I often read the source books for pen and paper RPGs that I have no intention of playing, just to learn about the world that they're set in. When it comes to games, this lore I love is so much buried in is so often buried in books, logs, or codex entries that I would love to absorb wholesale, but just can't. I know I'm missing out on some hot stuff, because I hear people like yourselves discussing elements of the Mass Effect world that I know are not covered by the game itself, but which are fascinating. The only game I've found so far that has solved this issue for me is, brace yourselves, not a PC game. Destiny and its companion app are perfect for this, as you can read all the codex entries you unlock in the game via the app. I've learnt a bunch about that world that would otherwise have passed me by while doing a poo. It's great. I'm at a loss as to how to solve this problem with other games, though. Have you got any suggestions, either for ways to help me read the things in-game, or for a way to access things like the Elder Scrolls games books or the Dragon Age Codex entries from outside the game? Tar Muchly Juice.
Date Chris. He reads that thing, so I don't have to.
Is that an open offer, Pip? Or is like, well, how does this happen? How does this work?
Well, I think it's more just that I am totally on board with this person's like approach to texting games and finding that it disintegrates into blah 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 after a certain amount of time. And I don't know whether that's because maybe I'm just in a different, like, I find it very difficult to go from the active playing to the more passive reading, or like engage that different bit of my brain that fishes out the concepts from the text to convert them into an imagined place. Like I kind of can't seem to make that switch again and again and again. And so I kind of go from wandering around a room that someone else has imagined and built for me to then having to suddenly convert something myself. It's kind of like someone repeatedly asking you to translate into a different language and then switch back and then translate again. It's a weird one and I don't get on with it. I'm far more likely to find out information when I realize I don't know it for a news story and consult a wiki and then fall down a rabbit hole of that and go, oh, I had no idea. And then like read more and more and more and go, oh, did you know? And then obviously Chris in the other room go, yes, and like, oh.
I'm really similar in that I have to kind of, if I know I'm getting into a very reedy game, then I need to kind of go in with the mindset of thinking, okay, this is just going to be a relaxing, gentle experience where I'm going to spend a lot of downtime reading stuff. I'm cool with that going into it. So Pillars of Eternity was the last big one that I actually properly kind of got through and just read a lot in. And it was brilliant having done so because I find the combination of just kind of passive text reading and game world to actually be like with enough investment really powerful, like because you create an extra dimension of kind of character and world building in your mind that, you know, that the game can't represent for you at all. I think the problem in a lot of cases is the reading environment that games generate for you tends to be very poor in terms of literally the spacing around the text and the space it gives you to read the text. It's always just the worst possible conditions for reading reams of text, anything, any sort of large paragraph. And this has always been true since, you know, the Baldur's Gate games and that era of kind of writing loads of text. Putting it into a tiny box where there's no room around the words, the font's been quite bad often, a lot of the spacing around it. I think there's just so much aesthetic kind of construction that is badly done about text in games. And this applies to codex entries and everything as well. Mass Effect is one of the best ones because you enter a full screen codex where it feels like you can enter into a reading environment and then process it on that level. Whereas so many games from like Sunless Sea through to Pillars of Eternity just cram stuff into small boxes with the game world still visible around them. And the game world is always going to be the part that you focus on, is always going to be a distraction of some kind when you're trying to get engaged with this text. So I think it's almost like an aesthetic thing a lot of the time.
Or you have one of those things that tries to fake out like it's a page from a book. Mm. And so it's done something weird with the font to make it look like handwriting or like calligraphy or, you know, and it's got like weird, like, you know, crinkled edges or like a curl to represent you being able to skip forward, but then the text itself doesn't quite fit because it's very much on the line still.
Yeah,
and you're
absolutely.
Kind of like, this, like, something about this is really like uncanny. And it's
like Skyrim books, you know, when you flip the page and then and a lot of these you see like a page turning animation and the text will appear like a millisecond later onto the page, that kind of stuff. And it's just it's strange, and I think it's just a bit alien. And also just reading off a bright high contrast high color screen is also going to be more stressful and more just kind of strenuous. And you know, you're not going to be encouraged to read long passages in that type of environment. I think if a lot of that stuff was kind of fixed, and people almost took on lessons from e-readers and stuff like that about how to create spaces for this stuff, then it would be much more palatable.
Either lessons from e-readers or lessons specifically from, I think, isn't it that thing where if you are trying to, for example, make something a bit more accessible if somebody has dyslexia or something, that you put like dark text on like a cream colored background maybe or something so that the high contrast isn't as jarring and as sort of like difficult for your eyes to deal with. Things like that, and like with particular fonts that either I can't remember whether it's a serif or a sans serif that is better for people's general sort of ability to process
the
words
serif,
and things, but essentially like And obviously it would come into massive conflict with maybe the design sensibility of the game. Like, oh, this doesn't look, I don't know, medieval, or this doesn't look sci-fi enough or whatever. But I think it maybe depends on whether that stuff is viewed by the developers as a kind of optional extra that the people who are interested will dig into, or if it's like a crucial part of the world building as to like how friendly a reading environment you you create, because I think that, for example, with the Destiny stuff, I think I absorbed a lot more than I usually do, and for similar reasons that the person who emailed said. But at the same time, like, none of that was necessary to my actual enjoyment of the game. So it was more that I just sort of would tool around on the app when I was on the bus sometimes. Whereas I think a few of the things in maybe in bigger RPGs that are more story focused, I probably did miss key points or the reasoning behind particular decisions, or, you know, the factors that should have gone into some of the decision making, because I just couldn't focus on the words.
Like, even as the person who will read everything in a game, like, I am very conscious of how pleasant an experience that is, like, in both in terms of where the game puts text. Like, I still think Son of the Sea is a huge own goal in that regard, because the life of that game is its text, and yet it occupies the smallest part of the screen. But also whether or not the game itself gives you, like good times to catch up on lore, like, if the rhythm of the game suits it, like Pillars does. But the way I would always handle it in Pillars is I always wait until, like, a certain amount of lore had built up, and then just park in a pub in-game and read it all, at which point the fact that the game is going on in the background doesn't feel distracting in the same way, because just the ambient noise of a pub is actually quite immersive to be reading through all these old books.
I'll tell you something, even though the Sunless Sea, I think, criticism is valid of it occupying very little screen real estate when it shows you a thing, the argument I would make in favour of that, and why I could sink into it in a way that I can't usually with text-based screen games of that kind, was that it only presents you with short snippets of story at each time, and because you're then travelling not massively excitingly to the next port, you're sort of in this weird lulled kind of headspace where you can process what you've just read. And I found that once I'd found my way into that game, that particular loop of short snippet, time to absorb it, next short snippet was lent itself to a really interesting layering effect that I thought was really helpful and did make things stick in my mind in a way that they don't usually.
The other thing I was going to add, though, that is, like, something to bring back to the game I've been playing, something that really stood out to me about Elite and has continued to stand out to me, is they do a lot of writing in that game. There's a lot of lore. They have a writing team or writer, I don't know who does it, who keeps their, like, daily news feed up to date. So there is in-game news that's updated every single day in real time. And but the biggest problem with that is a game where if you were ever really stopped or not flying your spaceship, you're probably not really playing the game, because it's all about moving. It's all about moving on to the next area and doing the next thing, and you got finite time. And it feels like a bit of an own goal, because loads of that game's UI is sort of beautifully diegetic. Like, you can look around inside the cockpit of your spaceship and almost multitask. You can be using a few different screens at once to achieve a few different things. However, the Galactic News Network is a full screen takeover thing, and your ship is still persistent while you're doing that. So you basically got to stop and bring it up and read it. And if that was a little window that you could glance over at while you're flying from A to B, particularly if you could do it while you're in hyperspace, when a lot of things are switched off, then it'd be the perfect thing to do. And it would stop me looking at my phone while traveling through hyperspace, which is what I tend to do.
Well, maybe if it did an audio, like newsreel.
Yeah, I mean, even that. But like, but more specifically, just give me something to read. And get, like, given that you're producing this thing already, just allow me to read it in the game in a way that's sort of flush with my experience. And it'd be perfect for that game, and it doesn't. The implementing was not quite right. So I think we've identified the right thing, which is the key here isn't really necessarily the writing or the amount of writing; it's the comfort and how natural it is to absorb it as you go. As soon as the reading experience isn't pleasant, or if it's slightly inconvenient, then I suspect 95% of people are going to completely miss it.
I tell you what, though, it's really nice to get that email, because I'm surrounded by a bunch of people who do read those things or have absorbed that stuff, or, you know, are so immersed in games in that particular way. And so it's really reassuring to hear that other people exist who are like, mate, I had no idea what that thing was about.
next up, Utkrist writes, and I apologize if I've pronounced that wrong. Dear destructible crates and damaging crowbars, I've been making games for a few years now and have realized that understanding the procedure of making games has changed my view on what I like and dislike in games. I've started to appreciate the polish that often went unseen in the past, and picking up details that I wouldn't have otherwise. These days I often find myself wondering about how certain systems and games are implemented while playing them, and why certain glitches occur as they do. My question for you fine folk is, have you tried making games? If so, has it changed your perception of the games others have made? If not, why haven't you tried yet? Thanks for answering, and cheers for the brilliant pod. Utkrisht, who's known as Fanatical on Discord. So, I haven't really made much headway into making games, although I'd like to, and I've, you know, got ideas and things. But this, I like this question partly because working in this industry and being around people who've made games of different kinds, from indie developers to visiting AAA studios and seeing the inside of the process, I think does change the way you subsequently receive games. Like, but to be honest, I suspect so does any experience of what it actually takes to create software generally, and to get things working and to get things done on time and to, you know, meet schedules and expectations of a load of different parties. I think inevitably, I'd be interested to see if anyone disagrees. Like, I think inevitably you become more sympathetic to how difficult it is to get any of this done. Like, my background before I was in web development before I was a games journalist and as a project manager specifically, and even at that super small scale in a much less technologically complex part of development, it's a surprising hassle to get a project done on time and to spec. And so I think I've maybe always been sympathetic, but working in this industry for 5 years or 5 years of exposure to this industry has definitely, you know, made me circumspect about the ways in which you criticize developers and what you necessarily expect from a game, and also what you appreciate in a game. Like, it always stands out to me when something seems to have been really, like, nailed on a lot of different counts and it sort of feels full and feature complete, and you can't see which corners were inevitably cut, because corners always are. That always stands out to me now, because it's almost like a little quiet project management victory as much as anything else.
Yeah, I've really come to appreciate more than anything, I think, just solid, satisfying interactions in games, and especially in 3D environments.
So yeah.
Stuff like Dragon's Dogma, a game which is, in many ways, doesn't have the kind of glamour and looks of, you know, a lot of modern RPGs. Just hitting things in that game and moving around and mantling and jumping and doing all this basic stuff feels really good in it. Mm. And there's a lot of expertise and skill goes into just making those simple interactions feel good. And that's almost, for me, just the one thing that needs to happen for me to persist with the game.
Yeah.
For its basic movement, jumping, clicking on things, just feel nice and be pleasurable. That's just such a kind of a core aspect of the fun of a virtual environment for me, that I deeply respect developers that really nail it.
Mm.
And not just in, you know, high octane combat games like DMC, but also in stuff like Dragon's Dogma, and, you know, Blizzard games are very good at this as well. I think I've come to value that more and more and more as I've played a lot of games. I'm not sure if actually kind of experimenting with programming has actually given me any extra insight into that. It's just more that that's the stuff that I've come to realize is harder to do than I realized was.
Yeah.
And maybe that's it. It's stuff that you think should be trivial, but actually it's incredibly difficult and takes a lot of time and iteration and skill and testing, and, you know, getting stuff right and smooth is very hard.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, yeah, I think I've always loved games that, like, you know, convey a sense of speed and have weapons that feel great, like, and that kind of thing from Tribes onwards. And it's only sort of now on reflection that you realize how complex it is to conceive of and implement those systems in the first place.
Yeah. I think maybe that's why, like, critically, we loved Titanfall 2 so much last year, but it was because it does so much of that stuff incredibly, incredibly well. And it might be a thing that it's got a great fantasy and stuff, but maybe that's the stuff that kind of we might value more for having just spent loads and loads of time with loads of games with kind of mediocre or, you know, not quite good enough interactions.
Yeah.
For a game to just nail every interaction, it just feels incredible.
I think one of the things that has been really valuable from my point of view is being in the position of my job letting me talk to the people who did particular things well, and just getting to ask them how it works. You know, like, I've been to talks that people who worked on the Destiny UI have given, and they have explained how they experimented with different speeds with which you could move the cursor around, and how it sort of has a slight gravitational pull when it goes over a thing that you might want to click on, so that it's a bit stickier on those things, and that's more pleasant for people to interact with. And it's little things like that that perhaps you don't notice when you're playing games, and you sort of, you feel that something is different, but you would struggle to maybe put your finger on the, I don't know, the three things that they've done differently that are not happening in the game that doesn't feel right. And so something that I have found really valuable is having access to that vocabulary, or at least talking to the people who have then said, oh, it's related to this thing, or you feel a sense of speed because we experimented with these three things, and, you know, with this particular combination, you end up sort of being more focused on a particular point further down a track, or, you know, things like that, there are so many moving parts to games. You can't process them all at once, particularly if it's requiring something of you not to fail in that moment. And sure. So that has been super valuable. I made a little Twine game really recently, but I would say that didn't really teach me anything, because it was more about just managing a story flow, and Twine is quite a simple tool to use, and it has been geared to make it so that people who don't know how to make games can make games. So that was more about just plugging a story idea I had and some artwork that I had made into a format that was easy to use. So yeah, it has very much been the act of talking to people, or having them explain why they had to adopt a certain thing. Even if it was just, well, we really wanted to do this, but we just couldn't make it work because the system doesn't allow us to do that, or it's not flexible enough, or technology hasn't come far enough that we could do it without it looking janky or weird or wonky, you know?
I think, expectations is a huge part of this, like the way it changes your expectations, and even from engine to engine, just kind of expecting a game to be able to do something, there's no way of you knowing at all what and that the engine they've selected can or can't do. Of course, they've chosen to select a particular engine and stuff like that, so it's a lot of self-imposed limitations in that respect, but it's very hard to go in and say, you know, I expect this to work this way, because you can't possibly say that, because you don't know. All you can say is this experience was bad, and it felt bad because of this, as far as I can detect. But of course, you can never detect the real reasons, which is the problem with being a games critic, because like you can't know the entirety of a game, because you can't know every fucking aspect of development and kind of twist of code and
or why things were prioritized over other things,
exactly,
or
budget
or at what
reasons.
Point it needed to be pushed out of the door, because completely incomprehensible from the outside, other reason,
yeah, precisely.
Mystery investment thing happening, or you know, yeah,
all you're left with is the experience and your personal reaction to it, and you just have to be honest about that and review that, really. But that maybe the answer to the question is that you discover the futility of your own position as a critic.
I think that's totally true. I think you discovered the limitations of your position
as
a critic,
yes,
which is not to make like ad hominem attacks on developers
for
based
sure.
on nothing.
Yeah, for sure.
Like that's the thing that, you know, I mean, I don't think I would have done that anyway, but it's certainly like, you know, meeting developers and understanding what it takes to make a game, make that harder to do. It makes it a lot harder to roll out something like lazy developers, which is the laziest criticism,
yeah,
ironically.
That's rubbish, yeah.
And
or couldn't they just have?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
It's the
you should realize that.
Right. It's like, yeah. Therein lies the million hours of rewriting code, because this one thing doesn't quite.
It's like people they're saying, "Oh, can't we just have this icon in the Diablo 3 UI?" And they're like, "Actually, you don't know what room the UI is fucking hard baked into this thing. Like, they couldn't just change it that simply, and you don't realize. You think it's a simple thing because." Yeah, it's just a 2D overlay, but no, there's loads of...
And that's not to say that you sort of give a pass on everything because you start realizing that it's difficult. It's more just that you really think about where the problems might have crept in or why they might have crept in, or, you know, sort of if you are going to sort of apportion, I guess, blame in some respect, but like being really careful about where you lay that, you know, or sort of, you know, just getting in touch with people and saying, you know, is this, this is coming across like this. Could you give me your take on it? And just sort of, I guess, investigating things a bit, asking questions and listening to people's responses.
Yeah, exactly. Like, or, but if you're simply doing active criticism on the game, you talk about the game rather than implying thought process or working conditions of the developer, because that's,
you don't know.
Minefield. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is trodden over every day by armies of commenters, but never mind. finally, our last question of the evening comes from Jonathan, who writes, "Dear overly fragile boxes and OP melee weapon. Long-time listener, but first-time writer, many thanks for your fantastic podcast." Thank you very much. "On my first playthrough of Dishonored 2 as Emily, I merrily stabbed and stealthed my way through the first level, and then got the option of a no-powers mode. Ooh, what if, I thought. So I restarted the game and did a not-spotted, no-killing, no-powers, no-bone-charbs run on the hard setting! Exclamation mark. It was very satisfying, and often frustrating, but I ended up really feeling I had beaten the game. Fantastic." So then goes on to just explain briefly that he then did a subsequent run on New Game Plus, mixed powers, but it felt like cheating. He then did another speedrun as Corvo, forcing himself to, you know, methodically do all the achievements. So now he has all of them. But, he says, "I overdid the first playthrough and sort of spoiled any replayability for myself. My questions are, have you ever ruined a game by overdoing it at the beginning? This can include just playing so much you get bored. And two, do achievements matter? Keep up the awesome work. Jonathan, P.S. If you can think of a challenge still left in the game, let me know before I uninstall it." So to answer that final part first, I found that, like, beyond, like, simply mastering Dishonored, the thing that lies beyond that is trying to tell yourself fun stories in Dishonored, whatever form that takes. So, you know, the video series I did was trying to make every murder in the first game look like an accident. You can also do trying to, you know, have everybody killed in the most unlikely possible way. But, like, beyond the simple challenge of the thing, I think the sort of treating it like a kind of sandbox for AI and physics where you can, I don't know, see how much you can break it. That is, you've not really finished Dishonored until you've really started to experiment with that. Until you can, I don't know, stick a trip razor mine onto a in-flight crossbow bolt and fire it into the sky so it lands on a passing tall boy in a minute from now, based on where you know it's going to be. That's the point at which you have finished. So I can't do that, but there are people on the internet who can.
The thing is, though, this entire thing seemed to lead to a question about, I have ruined this game's replayability for myself on the first playthrough. But they did then describe several more playthroughs, so I would say that they didn't ruin too much the replayability of said game. And no, they are asking you for suggestions for further replays.
I do kind of get what he means, though. Because when you invest a lot in, like, doing everything you possibly can, like, because I believe, like, I always want to play games the first time on the hardest setting where, you know, you really feel it, but not the hardest setting so that you can do it again. Because you kind of want the experience twice in a way, or at least twice. And so that's sometimes the tricky thing. If you're like min max hardest of all possible approaches mode the first time leaves you with no space to grow as a player in that game, then it can feel a bit anticlimactic, particularly when replaying the game is kind of the point. So, you know, that's why, like, when I saw that no weapons option in Dishonored 2, I was like, I'll come back for you in 3 playthroughs time after I've paced myself a little bit. A lot about pacing yourself. Like, I've done this for myself with RPGs, like, to return to a question from earlier, where you sort of binge on the lore too much to the point where you get bored, or you get distracted and you don't reconnect with the main plot because, as you have role-played it, your main character has just had some sort of journey-inciting initial incident and then sat in a pub read the entire history of their civilization, forgotten what they were doing, and vanished forever. So I do kind of get it. Like, I think pacing yourself in order to prolong your engagement with the game is an underrated challenge.
Don't eat the whole block of cheese. Leave it. Just shave bits off. Come back for it.
Is this a life lesson you've learned?
This is a life lesson I've learned, definitely.
This seems like hard-won wisdom.
No, I've fought hard not to eat all the cheese in one go.
Yeah, I suppose that's a lesson I learned eventually as well. Everyone learns that eventually.
Absolutely.
This is the thing. He ate the entire Dishonored cheese. Now there is only rind.
Well, I don't know. I don't really feel like I've got much to... Because I'm not really one for mining out games. I suppose I do in terms of things like Subnautica or Astroneer. Like, I kind of have my fill of them in early access, and then I worry that it's going to be many, many patches before I go back to them, because the impetus goes, because I'm like, well, I've seen everything that you've done.
This is a new anxiety, this idea of games in early access, where you don't know to what extent you're supposed to consume them and be done with them, or like leave them and let them come back. It's really weird. I don't know what to do with games like that, really.
Yeah, because in a weird way, like, financially they've made something from me, so that has presumably been a net good for the developer of that. But you know, it's as somebody who does creative things, you would like the person to still be enjoying it in some capacity, especially when it's at the point where you're like, but this is what it was supposed to be.
Yeah.
So I don't really know, like how to square that, because when the thing is there and when I'm enjoying it, I don't particularly want to stop, because what if I then don't come back because I forget it? You know, it's, what would the value of that be as well? You sort of get stuck in a kind of, at what point do I break off? When I'm still wanting more, or do I just play it out and then hope that it captivates me again in the future? Or
I think you've got to get as much out of it as whenever you know, in the moment as you can. Because the problem I always have with these things is that as soon as they get better and I go back to them, I stop thinking of them in terms of, you know, oh, here's this cool concept this game's trying to realise. And I start thinking, oh, this is way better than when I played it 8 months ago. Oh, look how polished it is. I'm thinking of it as a kind of, a mechanical entity, like a piece of clockwork, rather than the actual trying to enjoy the experience it's trying to deliver, which is sad.
I don't, I'm just trying to think if I have ever, I think there are games that I've, you know, tried to do all of the side quests or whatever it is as I've gone along, and then I just sort of, I feel so exhausted by that, or like by the idea of even trying it sometimes if you're faced with an Assassin's Creed map or something, that eventually I get to the point where I'm tapped out on that, and I go properly, you know, not slapdash, but I will just go straight for the main quest and just hope it ends soon.
On the broader point about achievements as well, I think these two things are related in that, like, there's a strange sort of, despite achievements being very fixed things, there's a strange sense of you having kind of like made the most of your time with a game or not, or have earned your achievements in a game or not, and feeling like you sort of cheated or skipped ahead, or kind of, you know, accidentally crashed through your first run is a very frustrating thing. And, you know, it's sometimes hard to get exactly right. Like, I must have spoken about this on the podcast before, but an old habit of mine in RPGs is to like restart them a couple of times until it feels right, which has nothing to do with necessarily feeling bored or unattached. It's just sort of like something flowing in the kind of the rhythm of the game, and whether or not you fail at a key moment. Things like untimely deaths can really put me off. Like, if you have some climactic moment, you know, some climactic encounter, and then the fight that follows, you fail immediately. If the story isn't equipped to account for you running back to that fight, that can often like kill a really dramatic moment for me, and sort of feel a bit sort of off, or in some way, or kind of like puncture the experience. Which again, you know, it's not maybe about overdoing it at the beginning, but it's about how sort of fragile that sort of sense of you having properly structured your journey through the game.
Yeah.
Is.
Don't scoff the cheese. Savour the cheese. And if needed, restart the cheese.
Exactly. Several times. Well, actually, speaking of eating too much cheese, like, this actually almost happened to me today, but a completely different achievement-based context. Achievement-based context, which is that, I guess 2 weeks ago now, I was kindly gifted a Fitbit, which is like a watch that tracks your fitness thing. Because I'm looking to lose a little bit of weight. And, there are things about it that are great, and there are things about particularly the app is programmed, and the app gives you like achievements for like walking a certain distance or climbing a hill or all these different things. And that's, it's not the point of doing any of it, because the point is being healthier, but there's a game likeness to that. There's a desire to get the things, and it's nice that you've achieved something today and you can feel a bit better about yourself. And I think those little moments of positive reinforcement are good especially in a context that can often be difficult for people to motivate themselves. However, this morning, I realized that it has no way of sense checking the data you've given it. So if you do a typo, it's taking that typo and it's fucking running with it. So this morning I accidentally told it that I lost in a week 150 pounds and I am an 160 pound man. So I told it that I had gone from 160 something pounds to 10 pounds.
Does not automatically call the emergency services.
No, exactly. Because I've
you
died.
Seem to be a brain in a jar.
Yeah, exactly. Like, your body is gone. Like,
well done.
Yeah. No.
20 points.
No, what it said was, well done. And it gave me every single achievement it can possibly give you. Because you set it like a goal for weight loss.
Yeah.
So I smashed that.
Because my
goal.
By dying. Yeah.
By dying. By like, you know, by basically like Obi-Wan Kenobi-ing the fuck out. Like, becoming just a rag on the floor.
How would he talk to a
What an excellent diet. Become a force ghost.
Exactly.
yeah, but then you're really fat. You're everywhere.
That's off. Anyway, let's not get into an argument about force ghosts. But then it literally, so in addition to, annoyingly, like, completing my exercise target, and saying, good, great job, you did it. And they're giving me the achievement for that and requiring that I set a new exercise target of the same value just so after I'd corrected the data input mistake.
Right.
It had also given me every weight loss progressive achievement up to 150 pounds. So 5 pounds, 10 pounds, 15, 20, 25, 30, and so on. All with their own little badges. And there's like an online profile that you can compare with your friends and stuff. And the stupid thing is that you can go into your profile online and you can manually delete every badge that you shouldn't have if you want to. And I think they added this because this must happen. Hmm. Right? You're entering data on a phone. People are going to fuck that up sometimes. And the fact that it doesn't like sense check it and go. And that wasn't the problem. Ultimately, I corrected the data and it is just a silly tracking thing. Like, it'll be fine. But there was this weird sense of, I was quite looking forward to earning that 10 pounds lost little badge.
It.
And I've enormously devalued it. Because as far as I'm concerned, I fucking won weight loss, right? Like, I managed to lose 96% of my body, according to this thing. And I'm never going to do that again, right? Like, I'm never going to hit those heady heights.
Until you die.
Until I die.
And decompose.
Yeah. And even then, it'll probably take a while for me to weigh that.
That's definitely true. Yeah. Much, much slower process.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, I'm going to have to, you know, like, now I have to be cremated. Thanks. You know, data entry issue.
That's much faster.
Yeah, exactly. That is a lot faster. And then I can be scattered. And then at the point where my
fat,
ashes, the point where
I'll
my
have to weigh you and then tell the Fitbit what happened to you.
At the point where my ashes weigh 10 pounds.
Right.
Tell the Fitbit.
No, when they weigh 9 pounds and 13. Yeah. No, yeah, sorry. Yeah, 10 pounds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then tell the Fitbit so that it can give me those achievements back, but not until then. Because I haven't earned them.
Oh, see, I kind of like had got a bit of a blank on the achievements because they kind of turned up every now and again. But like, I thought it was kind of a bit needy and it was trying to get my attention. So it was like, you've got the March of the Penguins achievement. And I'm like, I mean, sure, fine.
But you did go for a long walk with those penguins.
But like, and so it was kind of like you'd walked the same amount as a penguin would in a particular situation.
It's not an amazing
situation.
I know it is a good achievement, but at the same time, not an amazing sounding achievement, is it?
Well, it's kind of like, I mean, I like penguins, so I'm not ultimately upset about this. But yeah. At the same time, for me, it's kind of, I have a very strange relationship with this Fitbit, though. It's odd. Like, I get a bit confrontational and I'm a bit, like, you know, angry that it's, like, on my wrist and it keeps telling me things. And
yeah, sort of it's what it does.
I wish there was a column where I could explain that, that part of the year was Christmas and that this wasn't normal. And look, we're just going to start again in the new year and maybe we can be friends. But right now, we're not going to discuss
your shit, Fitbit.
The orange cream that I would quite like to have for breakfast, you know, like,
yes,
we just need to like enter into a kind of, you know, cordial, I don't know, treaty over Christmas period.
Fuck off, I'm feasting checkbox. Which yeah, you can
basically,
just kind of activate
like, I don't, oh, I don't want to have to deal with this bullshit. Yeah. You know?
I want to know what it would do if I was just ended my weight wrong and it was like, I weigh 19 tons now. Anyway, that is all of the questions we have time for.
Yeah, indeed. Otherwise you're going to hear all of my grievances about my Fitbit.
Yes. Mm. Let's throw our escape rope to the sky.
No more melons.
And earn ourselves an achievement for climbing out of our cardio or something. I don't know.
I think you get the lighthouse one for ascending a certain number of floors.
You probably do.
Mm.
Anyway, if you'd like to send us a question for a future episode, you can do so by emailing questions at creightoncrowbar.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at creightoncrowbar. If you'd like to hang out with our awesome community, you can do so on our Discord channel. The details for that are on the website, and we will figure out a short URL for that eventually, I promise. You can also find us on Patreon at patreon.com/CreightonCrowbar, which will be freshly updated as of today, hopefully, is the time you're listening to this. However, we're not going to charge for this episode or maybe even the next one. So if you sign up to support us, that's awesome. It will help us do more podcasts. It will help us cover the expenses of doing this podcast and build other projects around it. And we'll be announcing a little bit more about what format's going to take later in the week. However, you won't be charged at all, probably even for another couple of weeks, simply because the handover process for things like bank details and tax and all of that boring stuff is going to take us a little bit longer than we thought.
Shall we say probably first week of Feb?
Probably, yeah. But the way the Patreon works is you can sign up, you can even pledge an amount. The minimum is $1 per episode. But you're not charged at all unless we not only upload an episode to Patreon, but flag it. So what we're going to flag it as a paid thing. So what we're going to do is start uploading the episodes to Patreon again, just to set a precedent for it. But you won't even be getting charged for them for the time being. And then maybe start of February, we'll kick it into gear. As soon as all of the various admin essentially is done. But because we still have some of that resource left over from the last time the Patreon was live, we can start a lot of the things we were planning to do now and just use that those resources to tide us over while we sort everything else out. So that's the minor housekeeping update on that front. If you would like to follow us as individuals, you can do so. I'm at C Thurston, that's C-T-H-U-R-S-T-E-N.
I'm at PCG Ludo, which is L-U-D-O.
And I'm at Philippa War, which is P-H-I-L-I-P-P-A-W-A-R-R.
Wow, we got through that relatively without incident.
Bad, not bad. Mm.
Good job, everybody.
Yay!
Thanks, wine.
Yes.
No thank you, rum.
Or tea.
Indeed.
Disaster.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Yeah.